Welcome to Artrageous, a weekly podcast about the truly outrageous stories in the art and design world. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Artrageous. Last week was part one of this two-part story about two separate thefts of the screen paintings in Oslo, Norway. And yes, I said paintings, plural, because as we mentioned last week, there are actually multiple versions of the screen. The original 1893 painting was stolen in 1994 from the National Gallery in Oslo, Norway. And while that was a fun story, this week we're talking about the 1910 painting that was stolen from the Munch Museum in Oslo, Norway. Now, before we jump right into this story, I want to apologize for this being a two-parter. I tend to get really excited for these episodes, and I always find a ton of really great information that I want to share. So sometimes when picking topics, even the stories that I think, oh, this is going to be interesting and easy and it'll make for a nice quick episode, they end up turning into me saying, oh crap, there's more here than I thought. And then with my OCD, that ends up turning into part two of this story. I also have recorded this episode four times because this episode has been plagued with audio issues. So fingers crossed that fourth time's the charm and we can get this done. But hey, at the end of the day, I love sharing these stories with you guys, and I'm just flying by the seat of my pants trying to figure out the best way to bring topics to the podcast, and I'm really just guessing at how to structure these episodes. If you have any feedback, say you love the idea of two-part episodes and want to see more of them here and there, you can always let me know by leaving a review in your podcast app or by emailing me at artrageous.artpod@gmail.com. From week to week, it's mostly just me picking topics I find interesting. So if you want to send in ideas for episodes that you want me to dig into or just have feedback about the show, please feel free to reach out to me because I would love to hear from you. All right, now that that's out of the way, let's dive into the Scream Heist Part 2, the time the 1910 Scream painting was stolen from the Munch Museum in 2004. In case you haven't had a chance to listen to last week's episode, I think now would be a good time to give a super quick little background to set the scene for this story. The screen was first painted by Edvard Munch in 1893, and then he created another version of the painting in 1910. The screen quickly became one of the most famous paintings in the world, and to this day, its visual motifs can be seen all over the place. Of course, its influence can be seen in other artists, paintings, art movements, but even today, I think it's still a highly influential work. Even if you look at the emojis on an iPhone, there's one there that's this shocked-looking screaming face that I've been using for years, but now that I think about it, it's kind of like a mini modern-day Scream replica. And if you've ever seen the 2019 movie Velvet Buzzsaw with Jake Gyllenhaal, it's about a young woman working in a gallery who finds a whole bunch of paintings in her dead neighbor's apartment. She takes them because they're just going to be thrown out, and she then starts selling them. They're seen as these revolutionary works of art that are all the rage in the art market, but it's a thriller-type movie, so things start to get really weird. But I would say that if you look at the painting style of the paintings in the movie and just the overall tone of the work, I would argue that whether intentional or not, Velvet Buzzsaw has some visual and tonal motifs that are derivative of The Scream and some of Munch's other works. So yeah, Munch and his paintings were highly influential and highly popular. When Munch passed away in 1944, he left his artwork to the city of Oslo, and that's how the Munch Museum was formed and how it got its vast collection of works. Looking at the numbers for this museum, Munch was a super prolific artist. The museum alone holds 1,100 paintings, 18,000 prints, and 3,000 to 4,000 sketches, watercolors, and other works. Most everything was in Munch's own possession when he died in 1944, so all of it is now in the museum, whether on display or in archives or possibly out on loan. And yet with that vast collection, The Scream is still the crowning jewel of it all. We talked about the heist of the 1893 Scream painting in 1994 last week, and we learned a little about how it was basically negligence on behalf of the National Gallery that contributed to it being stolen. I thought Norway learned from that debacle, so how on earth was this painting, or rather the 1910 version, the target of yet another heist just 10 years later? Let's paint the picture here, shall we? On the warm summer Sunday morning of August 22, 2004, everything seemed normal at the Munch Museum in Oslo, Norway. But shortly after opening time at 11:05 a.m., a black Audi pulled up alongside the main building. Two men wearing gloves, ski masks, and hooded sweatshirts got out of the car and ran into the museum. The men started shouting and screaming at visitors, and they forced guards to the floor at the gunpoint of a .357 Magnum pistol. They made their way to the far side of the gallery towards two paintings, Monk's The Scream and Madonna. The thieves pulled the paintings from the wall, and almost as quickly as they arrived, they were gone. In under 5 minutes, they had stolen two of the most valuable paintings in the entire museum. It was a haul with an estimated worth over $100 million. By the time the police arrived, the thieves were long gone. The only evidence left was security footage with some indistinguishable faces and a puzzled and shocked group of museum patrons and staff that had little to no helpful information. No one could guess why the Scream had been targeted yet again, or even imagine how the thieves were going to sell one of the world's most famous artworks. But aside from the why, I think we need to look at the how. This is 2004, in a somewhat prominent museum where cameras, security personnel, and all kinds of security measures are in place. Even though we know from the Stefan Breitweiser episode that sometimes that doesn't necessarily matter and there's always ways around it, still, the idea of a museum heist as recent as 2004, less than 20 years ago, is almost screamingly unbelievable to think about. But bad puns aside, how did the thieves do it? Well, step one was to not use the main entrance, which would naturally be well monitored with security personnel. Instead, the cafeteria side entrance was their targeted entry point. They then ran past the front desk, which to me sounds really odd because if you go to the trouble of using a side entrance, then why would you run past the front desk? That just doesn't seem very smart. Well, I tried to look up a map of the museum, but all I could find were maps for the new museum that opened in 2021 that's about 13 stories high. The 2004 robbery was in a much smaller one-story museum. But looking at what I could find, it looks like the robbers almost had to travel past the front desk to get into the gallery. At which point, the museum staff saw the robbers and pressed a silent alarm button under the desk that notified not only the police, but also the museum's head of security. What I find absolutely hilarious is that when the thieves tried to enter the gallery, they didn't know which way the doors opened, and they basically ran into the door. We've all been there, pulling on a push door, feeling like a dork, but in this case, years after the fact, it's just a funny comic relief moment that I'm sure was an absolutely terrifying chain of events to actually live out. But once the thieves figured out that it was a pull door, not a push door, they made their way into the gallery. Being a small museum, there were only four guards on duty, so it was super easy for the robbers to subdue any guards they ran into by pointing a gun at them. From there, the museum was an open plan layout around a central room. Somehow the thieves managed to choose the long way around, but they took all of the radios off the guards as they went until they reached their target. Both the Scream and Madonna were hung from steel wire from the ceiling, hanging straight down along the wall, and they literally just tore it off the wire. Meanwhile, the getaway car was sitting outside and did not go unnoticed. Someone identified it as a black Audi, either an A4 or an A6 model, and they were able to give the license plate info to the police. So at least the police had some clue to go off of. As the thieves were escaping, they panicked and thought that maybe the frames to the pieces might contain some type of tracking device. So as they sped through the city, they were breaking up the frames and throwing pieces out of the car window as they drove. Ironically, the head of museum security saw some of those frame pieces as he was driving to the museum in response to that silent alarm being triggered. And of course, with it being such a famous painting, this whole story is perfect fuel for the media fire. We have armed robbery, violence, mystery. This whole thing is just so dramatic. So it's not surprising that news outlets from countries like Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and of course the United States were picking up the story and talking about it. That's just par for the course with a story as big as this one. What was crazy is that the news of the heist had spread so far that the museum director was getting phone calls from countries like the Philippines, Australia, Peru, just all of these countries that you don't hear about as much. They had media people calling the Munch Museum in Norway and asking for details. You can imagine that with all of this attention, the pressure on the police to find the missing paintings was pretty intense. In the hours immediately after the raid, officers traced the escape route taken by the thieves thanks to the pieces of the broken frames. Almost in a reverse Hansel and Gretel style, the police were able to use the frame fragments as a breadcrumb trail that led them to the getaway vehicle that they found parked next to an outdoor tennis court area not far from the museum. The police theorized that there was probably another vehicle waiting for them or that maybe picked them up not long after the heist. At this point, the Norwegian police were totally at a loss for what happened after their breadcrumb trail led to a dead end in the investigation. The thieves and the paintings had simply disappeared. Even the abandoned car provided very few clues to who the thieves were or where the paintings might have gone. The thieves must have known what they were doing because the interior of the car had been sprayed down with a dry fire extinguisher, which sounds odd until you realize that in doing so, it would make it incredibly difficult to find traces of human DNA in the car's interior, whether it was hair, fingerprints, whatever that might be. So super smart on the thieves' part if you think about it, but I won't give them too much credit because they also did something dumb that kind of negates the cleverness of their little fire extinguisher trick. They left the gun in the car. And of course, that gun was sent off for forensic examination. But with so little evidence to go on, a lot of people wondered if the 2004 robbery was linked to the 1994 heist. If we think back to that story in last week's episode, we know that the 1893 painting was stolen by a small group of people, two of which actually did the breaking and entering. Only one man served prison time, but by the time of the 2004 heist, he had already been released from prison for that sentence. And I realized in my research this week that I probably pronounced this guy's name wrong, so I'm going to try to get it right this week. But surely Paul Enge wouldn't have tried again, would he? Well, he did steal Munch's vampire painting in 1988 from the exact same museum as this current 2004 heist. At the time, he had just walked in the back entrance and stolen the painting right off the wall. We know he spent 5 years in prison for that theft, and we also know he spent time in prison for stealing another version of Munch's scream in that 1994 case, which to this day he still denies involvement in that heist. But it might not be that big of a stretch to think that he could do it again. I mean, what's the saying? Third time's the charm? But looking at the way the robbery was conducted, in the end, that armed robbery just wasn't his style, and there wasn't a good connection between Enge and the current theft. Sure, it would have been a great story if Enge had attempted to complete the trifecta of heists in the 80s, 90s, and now 2000s, but he just didn't match up as a prime suspect for the armed robbery in this 2004 heist. Even if the thieving tactics had matched Enge's style, there was also the simple fact that he was in the middle of serving a prison sentence for a different crime. So unless he was a behind-the-scenes mastermind, it would have been kind of hard for him to have a hand in this theft as well. Still, the police took the opportunity to ask him if he knew anything about the current theft. Enge said that he wasn't involved, but he did know who was. Of course, he wouldn't say more. Clearly, he was taking convict rule number one very seriously and didn't want to snitch. And that's understandable, considering after serving the five-year sentence for the 1994 theft, he was probably very wary to help authorities with this heist. And if you think about it, as soon as he said he knew something, authorities would probably think that he did it, and he definitely didn't want to spend more time in jail for something that he didn't do. Yet at the same time, he also believed that he had contacts in the Norwegian underground that could somehow help find the missing scream in Madonna. With Norway being so small, the people who were doing the crime in Norway is a super small group. And according to Enge, he had recently been in contact with these people and they trusted him. The authorities ended up not taking him up on this offer, but they did have another option. We'll talk about that more when we return. Welcome back, everyone. Let's get back into this story. When we left off, the Norwegian police had decided not to take the offer from a convicted thief named Paul Enge, who claimed he had connections with the thieves and could help find these paintings. At this point in the story, there's a couple different storylines happening, but I'll try my best to help clear up this narrative and make it make a little more sense. The first storyline is of a drag racing fanatic named Tomas Natos. In Norway, drag racing is a very popular sport among members of the Norwegian underground. They would come to the track and stop by Natos's shop sometimes to see what kind of cars he had or what he was working on. So that's basically how they first came into contact. Being so into drag racing, you know, you have to get cars from one place to another, especially if you're taking them to places outside of Norway. So Natos once used an old bus and trailer to transport his cars. That bus was eventually retired and dumped next to his workshop on a farm outside of Oslo. Well, one day, Natos got a call from a man named Petar Taraldsson, asking him if his old bus was still where it used to be, and if he could put something in the bus. Logically, Natos said, "No, you can't put anything in it. It's my bus." And that was kind of the end of that. Natos didn't really think anything more of that phone call until he got another phone call from Taraldsson again a bit later while he was away racing in Germany. Natos kind of brushed it off at the time until he was sitting in his hotel room watching the news. Remember how before the break I said that the theft of the Scream and Madonna was a worldwide news story? Well, the story had reached news stations, and Natos saw that there had been a big robbery in Norway. We've talked about this idea before, but considering that these are two very high-profile paintings that have just been stolen, what are the robbers going to do with them? I guess the thieves didn't really know either, and a potential solution was this abandoned bus. When Natos got back to Norway, he followed up on his suspicions and drove up to the farm where he kept his bus. The bus door was always unlocked and open, which would have provided entry to anyone. When he went inside, he could see that someone had been in there. Looking at the mattresses all the way in the back of the bus, he noticed that they were bowing upwards. When he looked underneath the mattresses, lo and behold, there was a painting underneath each of them. He had just stumbled upon the Screaming Madonna's hiding spots. At that point, he didn't know what to do. He thought about calling the police. I mean, there were probably 1,000 reasons why he should call the police. But it was the one reason, being the safety of his own life and his family's lives, that kept him from making that one, maybe not so simple phone call. So he just kept quiet and let the painting sit there, because what else could he do? While all of that was happening, our second storyline was unfolding. After hearing the news about the Scream and Madonna being stolen, a man named Petar Rosenvenja called a police officer named Johnny Brenna. Brenna is a plainclothes policeman who was working for the Oslo Organized Crime Unit, and Rosenvenja was one of his trusted informants in the Oslo underworld. The informant had seen reports of the robbery on the news and wanted to know whether Brenna had any more details about the getaway car. Rosenvenja told Brenna that he suspected the getaway car for the museum heist might just be the car that he had been repairing. Turns out, he was right. Rosenvenja's story was that he had prepared a car for a criminal associate, but he had no idea that the theft of the Scream was what the gang had in mind. Rosenvenja claimed he wasn't the man doing the robberies himself, but he knew the guys who were. To save his own skin, Rosenvenja was prepared to talk, and the names he gave to Johnny Brenna were all well-known criminals. He gave the names of Bjorn Hewen and Petar Taraldsson, the man who had asked Natos about the bus. Okay, so now these pieces and storylines are kind of falling together. We have a man named Rosenvenja, who was working on a car that was used in a museum heist, and one of the two people he named, Petar Taraldsson, had contacted a man named Natos about an old bus, which just so happens to be the temporary hiding place of Munch's Scream and Madonna paintings. Keep in mind, the police only know the first half of that at this point, since Natos had not called the police out of fear for his and his family's safety. I guess a good question to ask that will lead us into the third storyline is the question of why the paintings had been stolen. If such famous paintings were impossible to sell, what could have been the motive for the theft? The police thought that the answer might lie in a violent robbery that had been carried out on April 5th, 2004, just 4 months before the theft of the paintings from the Munch Museum. There's a quiet fishing town on the Atlantic coast of Norway that was home to a headquarters for Norway's Central Cash Services, also called NOCAS for short. On April 5th, 11 heavily armed men in full bulletproof uniform and masks arrived in the town center and rushed into the building. After locking workers in a separate room, they shot through protective glass and got their hands on $2.5 million in cash. As they were loading up all the cash, local police were already alerted and were on the way. By the time the robbers were leaving, police had already shown up, and the whole thing turned into a bloody shootout in the center of town that unfortunately resulted in the death of a police officer. The thieves somehow managed to escape, and this biggest and most violent bank robbery Norway had ever seen led to a huge police operation. That investigation was focused on a criminal network who, in the period of over a little more than a decade, had graduated from petty crime to armed robbery. They had started with car thefts and organized big burglaries in the 80s and then moved to armed robberies in the 90s. The police suspected the group might have up to 100 members, with a man named David Toska as the central leader of the organization. As that search for Tosca and the thieves was intensifying, the Munk Museum heist happened on August 22, 2004. During the investigation of the Munk Museum heist, there were several statements saying that Tosca, who was the leader of the bank heist gang, had orchestrated the robbery of the Munk Museum. But why? The alleged reason was that he wanted attention off of the police investigation into the bank robbery 4 months earlier. It's a compelling theory because at the time there were some 200 police resources working on the Nokas robbery case. And if you think about it, if the criminals could distract police with another crime that couldn't as easily be linked to them, the more time would pass from the Nokas robbery and the more likely it was that they wouldn't get caught. Now, the Norwegian police couldn't prove for certain that this was all true, but it was the most likely theory and there was plenty of circumstantial evidence to back it up. For example, Rosen Venya, who worked on the getaway car, and Tharaldsen, who asked about the bus, they were known associates of the gang's ringleader, David Tosca. There was also that gun found in the getaway car. The gun had been traced back to another robbery from a private villa in another town where guns were taken during the robbery. One of those guns was used during the Munk Museum heist, which was proven because the police had the gun from the getaway car. Another gun was seen in the CCTV footage of the Nokas bank robbery. That evidence suggested that the same gang was at work in both cases. So with all this information, it looks like about a month or so after the paintings were stolen, the police had a number of suspects under surveillance for both robberies. Police were on the brink of arresting key members of the gang, but they still needed to find the paintings, which we know are hidden in the bus. So the police got wiretaps on the phones of known gang members to see what they could potentially find. Well, at this point, it had been about a month since the museum heist, and the thieves were getting a bit anxious to move the paintings to a safer hiding spot. Even though it's likely that no one would ever guess that priceless paintings were being hidden in a random abandoned bus on a farm in the countryside, that still might not be the best place to keep them long term. So the thieves were getting anxious, and they started calling Natos to get him to help move the paintings. And of course, Natos didn't want to. He wanted no part of that mess, and these guys were just dragging him into it, but at the same time, he just wanted the paintings off of his bus. Ironically, the police had only had the wiretaps for one day when they overheard conversations about the plans with the bus and the arrangements that the thieves had made with Natos to move some sort of item or package. On the evening of September 23rd, 2004, a police surveillance car followed one of the suspects along a quiet country road to the farm where the bus was sitting. The problem that the police ran into is that this is an open country road, so they couldn't follow too closely without being seen, and they also really couldn't see what was going on. They saw the suspect's car pull over into the farm, at which point they pulled over, hid, and waited. A second car then showed up. Somehow, the police had found themselves within a few yards of the painting, and they had no clue. They couldn't really see what was going on because they were so far away, and it was also starting to get dark, so that surely didn't help either. When the two cars left the farm and went in opposite directions, there was only one police surveillance vehicle to follow them, so the cops had to choose which vehicle to follow. Unfortunately for them, they chose the wrong car. The black Mercedes with the paintings had gotten away and just drove off into the night. The police didn't realize until later just how close they had been and that the paintings had changed hands that night. To make matters even worse, that Mercedes with the paintings was later seen by yet another police surveillance car that was following up on the Nokas bank robbery case. It pulled up outside of the home of the fiancé of the prime suspect, David Tosca. And of course, those police officers were unaware of the paintings in the car either, because how would they have known? So twice that day, the police were so close, and yet the paintings weren't recovered and were still missing for almost 2 years. The search for the Scream and the Madonna became an international obsession to the point where there were people all over the world trying to help. There were psychics and witches from the Philippines calling the Munk Museum director saying that they could help track down the paintings if they could get access to another Munk work. This was so that they could sense the similar vibrations of the painting in front of them to help sense the vibrations from the stolen paintings out in the world and try to locate them. There was another psychic that said he sensed the paintings in Denmark, but lost contact and later discovered them again in America. Apparently, the reason he lost contact with the paintings was because he couldn't feel the vibrations over water. I don't know, there's a lot of interesting stories from the Munk Museum staff and police in regards to the recovery of these paintings. But ultimately, I think the police not being able to find these two famous paintings really seemed to fuel public interest in the robbery and the paintings themselves. One example is there was a children's board game created about the heist that had kids play as art detectives going in search of the missing painting. The point of the game was to retrieve the painting, not to teach kids how to become robbers, but it's still super interesting how one robbery and a couple of paintings can cause so much public interest. I mean, heck, I'm sitting here making a podcast episode on it almost 20 years later, if that tells you anything. Back to the robbery, though. 8 months after the Munch Museum had been robbed, police and prosecution moved against the suspects who they thought they had enough evidence on. Petter Rosenvenja was the first of several to be arrested in the hopes that their arrests would lead to the recovery of the painting. They had Rosenvenja with a clear self-confessed connection to the getaway car used in the heist. Then there was Petter Taraldsen, who was suspected of being the getaway car driver as seen by witnesses and was also the guy who had contacted Natos about the bus. Luckily, they didn't have to look too hard for Taraldsen because he was already in custody for another unconnected robbery. There was also a man named Bjorn Hewen, who Rosenvenja had named, and he was arrested as one of the suspected ringleaders. Those three were arrested in connection to the Scream heist, and then the other guy, David Tosca, was tracked down and arrested in Spain to face charges related to the armed bank robbery, but not yet for any role in the theft of the paintings in Oslo. From the time of the theft until a few weeks after the arrest, the Munch Museum had been closed to the public because I think they realized they needed to make some security updates. Within those 9 months that it had been closed, the museum spent $6.5 million on security makeovers. They installed metal detectors at the front door. They installed gallery barriers that only open by scanning a barcoded entrance ticket. There was also a one-way set of lockable doors that can trap any suspected thief. And they even updated the gallery layout, which, if you remember from the beginning of the episode, we talked about how it was a pretty open concept that allowed for the thieves to just run up to the painting, snag it off the wall, and run out in under a few minutes. Well, with the security updates, now visitors have to go through almost a labyrinth of walls to view the works, and combining that with other security measures, like another barrier at the exit, all of these changes are designed to hopefully slow down any would-be thieves to give police time to arrive before the suspects could leave the building. So yeah, I think they learned their security lessons and have now built the Fort Knox of security systems. For $6.5 million, if I was a betting person, I would say there's potentially other little booby traps for any suspects. But yeah, I think that's the good news, is that the gallery finally has a little bit better security measures. As for the thieves themselves, there was a trial against six defendants. The prosecution was asking for something like 12 years in prison, but they really didn't have much in the way of evidence that could prove some of the people were even involved. The police had built up their case with the wiretaps, interviews, and witnesses, but it was mostly made up of a lot of circumstantial evidence for this trial that lasted 7 weeks. Nearly 2 years after the theft, on May 2nd, 2006, the judge was finally ready to give his verdict and hand out sentences to the six accused. Of the six defendants, only three of the six were found guilty. Petter Rosenvenja was sentenced to 4 years in prison for prepping the getaway car. Petter Taraldsen was sentenced to 8 years in prison for driving the getaway car. And Bjorn Hewen was sentenced to 7 years in prison for acquiring the car for the purpose of robbery. As for the guy with the bus who didn't call the police, Natos was fully acquitted. But what about the two men who actually stole the paintings? Well, to this day, neither of the two men who actually did the robbing have been identified or found. And at the time of the sentencing, the paintings were still missing. The police thought they were still in the country and that they would be able to bring them back, but not much information was given aside from that. The police did slap a staggeringly hefty fine on two of the accused for 750 million Norwegian krone, equivalent to 124 million US dollars, which is also the estimated value of the missing paintings. The police were hoping that the fine would get the underground gang members talking and lead them to the return of the paintings. But that wouldn't happen for another 3 months. Then, all of a sudden, seemingly out of nowhere, on August 31st, 2006, the Norwegian police announced that the paintings had been recovered in a police operation, but they didn't exactly say what that operation was or how they got them back. Although some reports had suggested the paintings might have been destroyed, neither of the paintings were very badly damaged, and any damage the paintings did sustain were caused by basic carelessness and neglect. The head of the police investigation said, All that remains is an expert examination to confirm with 100% certainty that these are the original paintings. We believe that these are the originals. I saw the paintings today, and there was far from the damage that could have been feared. I was able to find a video from the Munk Museum where they talk about the damages that the Scream sustained from the theft. And I'll try to remember to include that link in the show notes, but really the only super noticeable damage is the bottom left corner where it looks like the painting got wet. Now keep in mind, both versions of the Scream were painted on cardboard. So if you've ever gotten a package from Amazon that got a little soggy and wet while it was sitting on the front porch waiting for you to come home and bring it in, then that's the kind of damage we're talking about here. The water damage did wash out some of the colors on that bottom left corner, but when conservators took a look at the painting and tried a couple restoration options on some mock-ups, they determined that it would be a little too risky to try any of those options on the actual painting. So for now, until they come up with something else or some new restoration technique is developed, they're just going to leave it as is so as not to cause more damage unintentionally. There's also some micro scratches on the surface of the painting that were caused by the glass breaking. If we look back to the beginning of the episode when I told the story of how the heist happened, you'll probably recall me talking about how, as the thieves were driving away, they were taking the pieces out of the frames and discarded those pieces along the road as they were driving. Well, when the glass broke, it scratched the surface of the paintings a bit, and some tiny pieces even became lodged into the surface of the painting. Conservators were able to remove some of those tiny pieces, but there are still fragments in the surface of the painting because, like with repairing the water damage, they didn't want to risk damaging the painting further. In the end, it really sucks that the painting was damaged a little, but for the most part, it's intact and looks pretty good, and at least it wasn't completely destroyed. Cardboard sitting in a dilapidated bus in the Norwegian countryside for a month sounds like some pretty sketchy conditions, so I think there was a little luck that nothing worse happened to these paintings. If anything, the damages just tell the history of the painting and remind us of this story. So personally, I'm not too mad that the damage hasn't been able to be repaired yet, and I almost kind of want to go see these paintings in person someday. So there you have it, everyone. That's the story of the 2004 Scream heist. And that also rounds out our two-part series on both Scream heists. How I ever thought I was going to get through both of these stories in one episode is beyond me. But I'm glad I broke it up into two parts so we could really focus on all the craziness in both of these stories. When I chose this topic and I started researching, I had absolutely no clue that this second story would have ties to organized crime and other robberies to the extent that it did. Even in the first episode, I wasn't expecting the soccer player turned art thief who also appeared in this episode when the police went to ask him about the 2004 theft. I tried to look it up, but I couldn't find anything on if Enger is still in jail, or if he's been released, or what that release date might be, so unfortunately, that's a bit of a loose end. There's also that undisclosed story of how the police found the Scream and the Madonna in August of 2006, but if something is released or I learn something new, then I would definitely be happy to share it with everyone on a quick follow-up episode or a bonus episode, just something like that to continue this story and round it out for the podcast. But speaking of future episodes, I think I have a tentative game plan for the next couple episodes. I just need to sit down and determine what order I want to do them in. Honestly, it might come down to just whatever I feel like when I start researching. But regardless, I will be back next week with another episode for you. So until then, stay outrageous. Series music created by Arensen. Music and transition sounds licensed from Motion Array. Artrageous is a proud partner of Stoveleg Media.
Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.